this is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, a busy week in Washington with hearings planned on immigration and the president's proposal on gun control.
And a bipartisan agreement in the Senate, Mark, that would pave the way for legalizing the 11 million immigrants who live in the country illegally. That would be positive on many levels, one of them being just a public health perspective, certainly making it easier for this population to access health services.
That's very important because immigrants suffer from so many untreated illnesses due to the lack of access. So this could be a positive step if the legislation makes it all the way through Congress.
But I think we'd both agree it's going to be harder to find bipartisan consensus in the talks on gun control. Mark, hard to imagine that with the nation's real obsession with guns, that this is going to be curbed by legislation. And yet with so many gun injuries and deaths per year, I have to agree with CDC and the American College of Physicians. We have got to talk about gun control in the context of public health.
And as part of that public health discussion is also focusing on behavioral health. And in spite of the mental health parity bill passed in Congress, there's still a big disconnect between those needing behavioral health services and those receiving them. So in a roundabout way, behavioral health may finally get the attention it deserves.
Well, I think we're going to see a lot of talk on the state level as well, aimed at addressing the difficulties in accessing behavioral health services, and probably in the light of recent events, looking specifically at schools as one place to deliver those services. And what else can be done to fill that void?
Our guest today certainly understands the importance of these issues. Dr. Barbara Van Dalen is the founder of Give an Hour, an organization dedicated to providing free mental health counseling for returning veterans and their family members as well.
About a fifth to a quarter of the soldiers returning from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan suffer from a multitude of lingering effects. There's so much need to help them grapple with post-traumatic stress disorder, with traumatic brain injury, or just the difficulties of adjusting to civilian life after multiple tours of duty. Dr. Van Dalen's organization is working with the White House and with the Veterans Health Administration to help address that need.
Dr. Van Dalen's work has earned her the distinction of Time Magazine's 100 People Who Are Changing the World. So really looking forward to our conversation with her today.
And also looking forward to hearing from Lori Robertson, the managing editor of factcheck.org, who is always on the hunt for mistruths that have been spoken in the public domain.
But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by Googling CHC Radio. And as always, if you have comments, email us at chcradio.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'd love to hear from you.
We'll get to our conversation with Dr. Van Dalen in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. A number of states around the country are looking at allocating more dollars towards overhauling mental health services. Legislatures in Florida, Illinois, and Minnesota, among states looking to increase budgets for behavioral health, and are looking at ways to improve services. Advocates in Illinois warn the mental health system in that state is simply broken and needs to be completely revamped. Meanwhile, the behavioral health discussion is being had with the backdrop of gun laws also on the block. In Massachusetts, a 43-year-old law which prohibits mental health information to be shared with the FBI, even for gun background checks. Governor Deval Patrick has twice attempted to pass legislation that would alleviate that restriction, but was unsuccessful. The measure comes up again. And as the GOP leadership gathered recently for their annual meeting, they agreed to continue to disagree, leadership recommending that the party faithful not give up the verbal commitment to seek ways to cut the federal budget using cuts to Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security, as well as other safety net programs. That in the wake of a new poll out by Kaiser Health, which shows a majority of Americans, near 70%, say they do not want to see any cuts to services for the elderly like Medicare and Social Security. And it may pain folks living with chronic pain to hear this, but the FDA is seriously considering restrictions on narcotic-based pain relievers like Vicodin. That class of painkillers, including Oxycontin, now causing more drug deaths than cocaine and heroin combined. Doctors would be barred from writing more than a 30-day prescription, and patients would be barred from renewing their medications without first coming in for another consult with a provider. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
Well, We're speaking today with Dr. Barbara Van Dalen, clinical psychologist, founder and director of Give an Hour, an organization that links soldiers returning from duty and their families to mental health clinicians volunteering their time. Dr. Van Dalen is a consultant to the White House, the Pentagon, and Veterans Administration, is also the founder of YouServe LLC, which links government agencies and nonprofits serving the military community. Dr. Van Dalen was named by Women's Day magazine as one of the 50 women who are changing the world and was on Time magazine's list of world's 100 most influential people in 2012 for her work. Dr. Van Dalen, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you very much.
Barbara, last year we just passed a pretty sobering milestone. More American GIs died in 2012 by suicides than died in combat. And that's just one aspect of the massive mental health problem being faced by our veterans and their families. When you founded Give an Hour in 2005, there simply wasn't enough attention being paid to those unique mental health issues. So tell us from a clinician's perspective about the depth and breadth of the mental health problems being faced by our military community.
First, it's really important to understand that what folks come home with in terms of post-traumatic stress, traumatic brain injury, the invisible injuries of war, if you will, we would expect this. It makes sense. This is a human reaction to war, to the atrocities that service members see, the traumatic brain injuries, to the kinds of blasts that they're exposed to. And in fact, most of our service members who come home do not develop severe forms of PTSD and are reintegrating back into our society. That doesn't mean that there aren't difficulties with just regular old reintegration after being away, but it is a range of issues, and it's important to think about it as a continuum. So you have everyone from the service member who's been away for, you know, multiple tours over the last 10 years, is coming home now. He's actually doing okay, he or she, but a transition back to life with your family after spending so much time away, a transition to a different kind of job, a different kind of life, that's challenging and comes with all sorts of mental health adaptations required, all the way to service members who have experienced very severe and brutal combat, are coming home with post-traumatic stress, and sometimes a traumatic brain injury. And then in their effort to deal with that, sometimes you see substance issues in their attempt to self-medicate. Most service members, they come home and they're assets in our community. The goal is for us to make sure we provide what they need so that they can become that.
Barbara, as a clinical psychologist, you and your colleagues are trained to confront these many issues. But when you founded Give an Hour, you had a vision in mind, and I'm sure you had to quickly move from the vision to the strategy of how are you going to make this work and meet this huge unmet need. So perhaps share with us, how exactly does Give an Hour work?
Sure. Well, the idea is very simple, and I think that's why it works. The concept was really to ask mental health professionals to give an hour a week of their time, to build it into their clinical practice, to do it at a time that worked for them. So we wanted to make it easy for folks to give. And on the other side, make it very easy for those in need to receive. So service members, veterans, military family members come to our website. They put in their zip code, and they get a list of providers in their area. We have now over 6,500 providers throughout the country. If they can't find someone right in their community, then that flags us. And our staff steps in and starts working with our broad network to locate a provider. And they start doing the work that leads them to heal and get what they need to move on with their lives.
Barbara, that's a great innovation. And it sounded like you worked with the founder of Craigslist to develop this clearinghouse of mental health clinicians across the country. Tell us about that collaboration and how do you determine which providers would be most helpful and what other hurdles do you face and how do you overcome them?
It was Craigslist that was the inspiration. I was, at the time, a single mom in Washington, D.C., raising my two daughters. You know, I had two busy practices, and I was fascinated with here we could find, I could find a child care provider who was moving from across the country, moving to Washington, and we could trade information and end up matching so that that person came to work and live in my family. And I thought, this is great if we can use this model to match those in need with those who are offering services. So that was really what led me to start to talk to folks who are far smarter than me on the technology side. we built our first version of Given Hour with open source software. And later, then down the road, I met Craig and we talked about this notion of, again, keeping it very simple so that those who are looking for a service, in this case, free mental health care, can easily go to a site, use their zip code, and there they have a whole list of folks who are available to them. And it makes it very easy for our providers because they're in charge of the hours that they offer, of what services, and that gets to your question about who's the most appropriate and the most effective. We believe that all mental health professionals are needed for this current generation of folks coming home because it's not just those who are severely injured. Mm-hmm. It's folks who are transitioning and dealing with family issues, or it's the parent of a service member or the sibling of. So everyone who has mental health expertise can really serve a very critical role right now.
I'd like to, Barbara, look a little more deeply into these innovations that you're spearheading as part of this mission. You know, there's so many hundreds of thousands, I would imagine, of veterans needing help. We may need more than just our clinical volunteers, but something that you've called this community blueprint. Tell us about the community blueprint. What's in it, and how does that relate to this model of care that you're hoping to see provided?
Yes, as I began building Given Hour 7 years ago and traveling around the country, what was clear is that all over our country, folks were stepping up and trying to help, yet there was not very much collaboration or coordination. And I'm talking now across services, mental health, healthcare, employment, education for these service members and their families. And so a number of my colleagues and I got together and started to talk about what if we created some tools for communities. That led to the development of what is now the initiative known as the Community Blueprint. And the idea, like Given Hour, is very simple. It's very action-oriented. Let's get the stakeholders in a community together, and then we offer them a whole slate of very concrete next steps. If you want to create a job fair, here's what it looks like. If you want to train your civilian mental health professionals, here's how it's been done in other communities. It affects employment, education, family life. The homeless population, unfortunately, has many veterans. We're dealing with that as an issue. So the community blueprint is a way, literally, to organize communities at the community level and bring folks together and then help them move forward with action-oriented plans.
We're speaking today with Dr. Barbara Van Dalen, clinical psychologist, founder and director of Given Hour, an organization that links soldiers returning from duty and their families to mental health, clinicians volunteering their time. Barbara, tell us a little bit about the Obama administration's initiative they launched last year in partnership with 100 teaching hospitals across the country. Now, how is this initiative helping you and your colleagues prepare the next generation of clinicians to address this great behavioral health need?
Very soon after the president came into office in 2008, the First Lady and Dr. Biden got together to create the Joining Forces initiative, and that led to identifying all variety of opportunities to literally encourage individuals, organizations, colleges, universities to step up and join forces. And it's been delightful to work with many wonderful folks at the White House, connect that with the Community Blueprint, with Given Hour. The White House provides a wonderful platform. It encourages colleges and universities to look at their programs and really make sure that those up-and-coming professionals are properly trained, because without that knowledge and expertise, then we miss opportunities to provide what these men and women and their families deserve. I feel very hopeful because all of the key players in our country at all the different levels of state, local, federal, we're stepping up, working together. It's a huge issue to tackle, but I feel very optimistic about where we're heading.
Barbara, in the work that your volunteers are doing, I think, as I understand it, it's primarily a traditional in-person counseling sessions, and certainly a very valuable and effective model. But as we look at the distribution gaps between rural and urban areas and the distribution of providers and the role that technology might play in helping bring treatment to people who have difficulty getting to that sort of traditional in-person session, what are you looking at with other technologies using Skype, teleconferencing, texting as part of a treatment paradigm? And is this something that you look to incorporate into your work?
The relationship is so critical as people heal from mental health issues. And so, yes, we do maintain the opportunity for folks to meet with clinicians individually. And then from the beginning, we also offered a very low-tech solution for folks who live in rural communities or just couldn't get into an office, and that's phone support. Because even if you can't make it into an office, to have an opportunity to speak with a clinician to get support, critically valuable. So we've offered that from the beginning. We also started very early on sending our clinicians out into the community to assist in a lot of different ways. So they now give talks at community centers, or they'll brief families at reintegration events. So from the beginning, we saw that we had harnessed this wonderful resource, and the goal was to figure out how many different ways could we apply it. And now we are very much looking at telehealth as an opportunity that we will be offering. And we have expanded so quickly, the goal for us is to keep up with what we're being asked to do. We will, in fact, have the funding to put into place a telehealth capability so that our providers, wherever they are in a state, can, in fact, provide face-to-face contact with service members and their families. So there's tremendous opportunity through technology to provide support, education, and care, and we plan to explore and expand in as many directions as we can. In fact, with 1 million service members separating over the next several years, we're going to see a very long tail on these issues.
Barbara, we really love the model you've developed at Given Hour and really where you're taking it. I love the sort of high-tech, high-touch aspects of it as you think about moving forward. But the recipients are also being asked to give back in a meaningful way where they can. And talk to us for a moment about this culture of volunteerism and giving back as it relates to the success of the healing process. And can you give us some examples of the sort of impact it's having and on those you're trying to help?
Absolutely. And it's probably one of my favorite features of the organization. And it really comes from my dad. My dad was a veteran of World War II, and he was in combat in the Pacific, and he never talked about it. And so I know very little about that. He passed away in 1986. Yet, growing up, his service to our community was such a strong message in my life. And I knew that when I was building Given Hour, given the people that we were going to serve, that it was critical that we offer them the opportunity to give back.
What's the sort of institutional partnership with the VA system, as an example, or with state mental health authorities, so that the volunteer therapist is not feeling out there on their own and the veteran can get the help they needed? I'm sure you're engaged in sort of policy discussions around that. Can you share that with us a little bit?
Well, it's been a wonderful evolution of thought and policy. And it's true, Given Hour is outpatient mental health care. We don't provide inpatient services. That's not how we're equipped. It is a clearinghouse, if you will. It is mental health professionals stepping up, offering their significant expertise, but staying within their lane. And so it's very important that we at Given Hour have backup. The good news is that we've not had to rely on that type of backup very often. Our providers are so skilled. When folks come to us, we're pretty good at figuring out what they need. If they can't be seen in an outpatient setting, we do have great relationships with the VA and with DOD. And because we're in every state and we're connected to every major mental health association and we have friends on the Hill and at the White House, we're able to then access whether it's state, local. And so far, we have been successful. We've never had to turn someone away. We've always been able to find either a provider or a greater level of care through a VA contact. So the system is working well. And what's important is this collaboration. It is where we need to head, which is how do we look to leverage what the different skills, capacities are, connect the dots, then we can take care of our citizens and take care of our own, so to speak. And there's a new movement that I'm very proud to be part of and I guess a spokesperson for, and that is harnessing skill-based volunteers, whether it's, you know, the good work of Doctors Without Borders, folks at Given Hour, or other groups. How do we harness, leverage those specific volunteers who have the skills needed, and how do we make sure that, as you said, they are supported?
We've been speaking today with Dr. Barbara Van Dalen, founder and director of Give an Hour, which links veterans and their families with a network of volunteer mental health counselors to treat the effects of PTSD and other war-related brain injuries. She's been recognized as one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential people in the world for her work. You can find out more by going to giveanhour.org. Barbara, thank you so much for the work you do and for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you. It's a pleasure, and thank you again for covering these important topics.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Laurie Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Laurie, what have you got for us this week?
Well, Mark and Margaret, we noticed a statistic floating around Facebook about children and gun deaths in the U.S. The statistic is that 85% of children that are killed with guns are killed in the United States. And it was used on ABC News by Mark Kelly, former astronaut and husband of former Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords. Now, that shocking statistic is attracting attention on social media, but it's not true. Kelly left out an important qualifier. The study he cited looked at the 23 highest income countries in the world in 2003 and found that 87% of children under age 15 who were killed by guns in those countries lived in the U.S. So it's not 85 or actually 87% of all child gun deaths in the world, but rather 87% of the deaths in the 23 highest income countries. That, of course, does show that child gun deaths in the U.S. far outnumbered those in similar countries, including Australia, Canada, France, Germany, Japan, Finland, New Zealand, Norway, the United Kingdom, and others. But without that important qualifier, many may get the impression that the statistic includes violence-plagued countries in Central and South America or Africa, where gun homicide rates far outpace that of the United States. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Laurie Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Laurie Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Vaccinations are considered one of the great public health achievements of the 20th century, reducing fatalities from most common and fatal diseases by up to 99%. But in the 21st century, some of those numbers just aren't stacking up. As recently as 2009, only 45% of the nation's preschool-age children had received all of their recommended vaccinations and boosters. And researchers at the Children's Outcome Research Program at Children's Hospital in Colorado decided to take an in-depth look at the problem.
Primary care practitioners are so overstretched. There are so many competing demands that it's rather impractical.
Dr. Allison Kemp heads up the Children's Outcome Research Program, and she conducted a study on what would help to generate better compliance with the required vaccinations, which is a goal of the government's Healthy People 2020 initiative. And she found that when parents received timely reminders from their state and local health departments, parents were much more likely to get the vaccinations and boosters for their children that they needed.
What our study did was to centralize those efforts. So it didn't take away from the primary care providers, but it helped them to do the reminder recall for their practices centrally using a state registry. So this was much more efficient and much more cost efficient.
Dr. Kemp says her research shows that when a reminder message can be generated for an entire population across communities, it takes the onus and the burden off of the primary care and pediatric practices. Her study, published in the December issue of the American Journal of Public Health, showed that those effects were pretty significant.
In a fairly short 6-month period in the counties where this was done centrally, about 19% of children who were not up to date became up to date, versus about 13% in the practice-based recall states, which on a population level within 6 months is really very powerful.
And the study also suggests that there's a cost savings with a centralized state or county-run database and reminder system, both in terms of the vaccines themselves and in reduced medical costs as fewer children fall ill.
You know, you have one case of influenza, Haemophilus meningitis, can cost tens of thousands of dollars. The costs are of not preventing these illnesses are very high.
A state health department-driven vaccination program that assists private practices in vaccine compliance for their patient population, improving vaccination rates of young and vulnerable children, now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.